A celebrated educator who once led the university at Albany, New York, passed away this month. She also co-hosted this program for about a decade.
I hope my legacy would be one of communication.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we remember Dr. Karen Hitchcock. We'll also have a conversation about freedom of speech on campus with the president of a college in Massachusetts, and we'll spend an academic minute trying to define meat. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Karen Hitchcock passed away this month after a lengthy illness. In 1995, Dr. Hitchcock became the first woman to hold the office of president at the University at Albany. She remained in that position for about a decade and then became the first woman to hold the office of principal at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Shortly after she took over at UAlbany, she took on another position, the co-host of this program, The Best of Our Knowledge. Last fall, Dr. Hitchcock was one of three recipients of the University at Albany Foundation's Citizen Laureate Awards. At the time, she spoke with The Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas about that award and her long career as an educator.
Well, I was very honored to be selected for what's known as the Academic Laureate. That's part of the Citizen Laureate award program that the University at Albany Foundation has granted to people in the community for many years. I was very honored to receive the Academic Laureate, given that it recognizes both professional life, research, and teaching, my life in the academy, as well as service to the community.
Currently a special advisor at Park Strategies, Hitchcock was named the 16th and first female president of UAlbany in 1994, leaving for Canada after 10 years to head Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. After that, it was a return home to Albany. Hitchcock says her UAlbany presidency was a wonderful opportunity.
To be the first female president was a great honor. I was always so impressed with the ability of the community, both within and without the university, to look at what someone's credentials and what their vision might be for the university before other considerations. So it was a challenging time, but a very exciting time, and one filled with the opportunity to make wonderful connections, if you will, for the university.
Hitchcock also served as chair of the Business Higher Education Roundtable.
As I looked at what the needs of the university were, but also all universities across the United States, the need to relate more closely to the community that supported each university was very important. The need for relevance was very important. So we needed to have a very close dialogue with the people that we served, and that was certainly, of course, our students, but also the community, the businesses, the organizations that with the university were looking to enhance the economic growth and vitality of the region. So we put together a group of university presidents as well as CEOs of many of the businesses in the region, so we could sit down and have good dialogue about what needs were, where universities could play a part in helping to meet those needs, be it in workforce development or particular research programs. And businesses could appreciate the challenges being faced by higher education during those times. So it was a very fruitful, very rewarding set of relationships which persist to this day.
Hitchcock has served on many boards in the Capital Region and has been a long-time on-air presence at WAMC, including co-hosting The Best of Our Knowledge.
Oh, that was a wonderful experience, and I'll always be grateful to our leader, Alan Chartok, for making that happen. It was a wonderful time because it enabled us to address a lot of the issues facing higher education in a format that allowed for input from the community as far as what kinds of things they wanted to hear. I also had the experience of taking that on the road, and we broadcast that from Canada when I was principal of Queen's University in Ontario. That was wonderful. We were able to interview everyone from the main Canadian astronaut to someone who's since won the Nobel Prize.
Hitchcock believes her legacy will inspire unity.
Well, I hope my legacy would be one of communication, one that looks to involve people from multiple sectors to address issues from different points of view, different backgrounds, different contexts, and one where coming together in that way in the form of a team, be it in research, be it in scientific research, or be it in trying to bring the giants to the Capital Region, the nanotechnology initiative, all of that was the result of people from different sectors coming together. So I would hope relationship building, communication would be a part of my legacy.
Hitchcock believes higher ed has become more community-centric since she got started in education and research.
The institutions of higher education have become aware that they really must look to relevance. They must look to the needs of the communities they serve, and they need to be part of the discourse that is informing our political life, our intellectual life, everything from workforce development to the most sophisticated, esoteric, some might say, areas of research. All of that has to be part of the agenda of a vibrant university. It's past the time where simply one can say everyone should go to college, and that defines us. Universities have huge roles to play in advancing knowledge and also in looking to the economic vitality of the regions they serve, looking at the quality of life. They have to be more expansive in their mission, and that's a change. Universities many, many years ago certainly were ivory towers, but they're not any longer. They're doing a wonderful job, I think, in most cases, to relate to their constituencies. As I said at the awards ceremony, this is a mission where I've been associated with organizations that really have one strong calling, and that's to make everyone associated with it better for that association. It's a place where people come, and our role is a simple one, very difficult one, but a very straightforward one, and that's so that everyone can fulfill their potential. And that's an honor, and it's been a thrill all my life to be part of an organization whose mission is to try to assist everyone in making the most of their talents.
And of course, Dr. Karen Hitchcock spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas. After leaving the Best of Our Knowledge, Dr. Hitchcock remained a frequent commentator on education issues on Northeast Public Radio. Here is one of her commentaries from 2014 on an issue that's still controversial around the country, freedom of speech on campus.
Each year, graduates of our nation's colleges and universities participate in an ancient ritual known as commencement. They don medieval garb and participate in a ceremony designed to honor their accomplishments and be celebrated by their final teacher, the famed commencement speaker. For any incumbent university or college president, the choice of such speakers is one of the most difficult faced in the course of the academic year. The very diversity of individuals, opinions, and policy perspectives, which makes for a vibrant, robust higher education learning environment, also guarantees some controversy around any particular individual chosen to be the embodiment of their institution on this critical day in the lives of the graduates. Best, certainly, to involve students in the decision. And so we did during the 13 years I served as a university president here in the U.S. and in Canada. Protests from vocal opponents still occurred, but they occurred in the context of an inclusive process of selection. The discussions this year surrounding the numerous withdrawals of commencement speakers following student and faculty protests were especially heated. A number of very well-known and in many circles well-respected commencement speakers withdrew to avoid becoming, in the words of one such speaker designee, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, quote, "a distraction for the university community at this very special time," end quote. Whether the decision of the invited speaker or a polite suggestion by the host college or university, I don't remember a time when more high-profile commencement speaker designees changed prior to the ceremony for which they were selected. This truly became, as Greg Lukianoff, president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, put it, a disinvitation season. From the chief of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, to Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State, to Robert J. Bergeau, former Chancellor of the University of California at Berkeley, and on, protests have arisen over particular policy positions each has taken. Indeed, it is difficult to imagine a public figure who has not, at some time in their career, proposed a course of action or expressed a point of view which was counter to the beliefs of some portion of the citizenry. The real question we as leaders of institutions of higher education need to ask is whether someone chosen for the honor of addressing our graduates represents, in their worldview and in the totality of their career, the core values of our institution. Do they exemplify the habits of mind and the strengths of character we espouse? If they do, I would submit that despite vocal protests from the few or even the many, they should be celebrated by the institution and remain on the commencement podium. Individuals have attempted to cast this discussion in terms of political correctness run amok, conservative versus liberal, liberal versus conservative, a tyranny of the vocal minority, violation of the First Amendment, or simply a weakness of institutional leadership. I would submit that it is none of the above. Rather, these events represent the consequences of not placing the fulfillment of institutional values above all other considerations. If a potential speaker in the minds of a representative group of students, faculty, and administrators embodies institutional values, they should be embraced and supported, certainly not disinvited if the going gets tough due to the actions of a minority faction of vocal protesters. Likewise, the speakers need to be willing to, yes, speak to the backs of those that oppose some of the actions they have taken. Such courage will deliver a powerful message to all of the graduates, one that will be remembered long after the particular words of the commencement speech fade from their memories.
That was Dr. Karen Hitchcock in a commentary that ran on Northeast Public Radio in 2014. Again, Dr. Hitchcock passed away earlier this month. She was 76. Well, still to come, like we said, freedom of speech on campus is still a big issue. We'll explore it with another college president next on The Best of Our Knowledge. got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Like many college campuses around the country, Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts has struggled on how to balance campus concerns about free speech and open inquiry with fears of promoting hate speech and violent ideologies. Williams President Maud Mandel assembled an ad hoc committee to explore the issue at the private liberal arts college. Mandel spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Josh Landis about the findings.
Last fall at Williams, there was a group of faculty that was interested in sparking a conversation on campus about whether Williams should sign the Chicago Principles, which is a document endorsing free speech and expression on campuses. And in response to that petition, which a number of faculty signed, there were students and alumni and some faculty who expressed some concerns about the particulars of the Chicago Principles. And in response to that controversy, I put together a working group to explore the topic of free inquiry and inclusion.
Now, this predates just last year. Williams had a number of conversations about free speech on its campus. Can you speak to any of those longer issues that came in before you were in office?
Yeah, before my time here at Williams, like at many campuses across the United States, there had been some controversies around speakers and really a range of issues related to hate speech and the ways in which speech should or should not be regulated on a campus. So there were some controversies here, as I say, like in many places. So it wasn't the beginning of the conversation at Williams. And in fact, as I was arriving on campus, many people brought the issue up with me.
When that faculty petition came to you about the Chicago Principles, what was your initial response to it?
Well, I think initially I was interested in hearing what folks on campus had to say about the issue. I was not surprised at all by the range of opinions around the Chicago Principles per se. Again, that's a debate that's been happening across the country, so the kinds of issues that were raised at Williams weren't particularly surprising to me. But I was very pleased, actually, to have an opportunity to do a more systematic and deeper conversation about the topic here, which the ad hoc committee really has moved forward in very nice and productive ways.
Now that the committee's delivered a final report, what are the major takeaways from it?
So the report was really extraordinary, in part because they took very seriously the charge that I put forward, that they do deep research and community engagement around the twin commitments of free inquiry and inclusion. And I think these two areas often in the mainstream media and public opinion are treated as incompatible. But we here really believe that a great college and even a great democracy require both freedom and equality of opportunity. And the report really stressed that. They did a really terrific outreach. So they held over 30 meetings with all kinds of college groups, everyone from the Committee on Diversity and Community to Dining Services to our Society of Alumni Volunteers. They did an online survey, a postcard campaign, many hours of open hours, et cetera. And in doing that, they got a really broad sense, I think, of what Williams College thinks about the issues of free inquiry and inclusion and how we can continue to forward both of these commitments. And I think their takeaways, to answer your question, were really interesting, that they certainly heard very little support at Williams for a no-platform policy or for disinviting speakers and performers, but also a small minority of voices that strongly differed on this issue. They also found out that very few respondents believe the college's hosting of an outside speaker equals an endorsement of that viewpoint. And most interestingly, I think to me, they found that students and faculty strongly supported event formats that allow for multi-sided exchange and debate. And that's something I think that a college should really engage in when inviting folks from off campus to speak.
As far as specific guidelines moving forward, do you have a better sense of what kind of speakers maybe wouldn't make the cut in this new set of established rules that you're putting together?
Well, I think it's not. Are you asking specifically, would there be times that we wouldn't invite somebody into campus? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that the report makes it very clear that Williams should adhere to strong pro-speech policies and principles articulated by the American Association of University Professors and PEN America. Both of those documents suggest that one would only turn down a speaker in case he is really a very dramatic safety threat for campus. But I think it's very important to say that what the report emphasized wasn't so much when you do or don't cancel a speaker, but rather what you do to ensure that when a speaker comes to campus, that we have the most powerful learning outcomes possible, which means thinking very carefully about how the speaker engages with students, faculty, staff, and community members when they're on campus, how we prepare the campus for their coming, what other kinds of events we schedule around it. So it's not so much about whether they come or not, but what they're doing when they're here and how do we make it as educationally valuable as possible.
Given the very confrontational nature of the conversation around this issue on college campuses, how do you plan on translating these findings into a kind of understanding that might, you know, assuage the fears of people on campus?
Well, I think the key to answering that question really is about, again, what we do around speakers coming, how we prepare the campus and what we do subsequently after somebody comes in order to engage the range of issues that have emerged. But I think it's also worth noting, and I think the report makes this clear, that one of the things the campus disagrees about is the boundaries of this very issue of where free inquiry clashes or can clash with people's concern about the kinds of speech that are understood to be as hate speech. And so that's one of the things the community is arguing about. And in fact, one of the events this year that I thought was very successful on campus was a debate that was held or a discussion that was held with speakers around the free speech issue. And in fact, we had just the kind of heated, engaged conversation about free speech that that marks, I think, Williams as a very engaged learning community where people can disagree and still engage in important conversation.
Recently, the college administration has clashed with its own student government over this very issue about free speech. I'm speaking, of course, about the Williams Initiative for Israel conversation from earlier this year. How does the findings of this committee play into that debate over what constitutes hate speech at Williams?
Yeah, to be clear, I don't think the Wi-Fi event was really about free speech as such. This was a situation in which a student group was trying to form a group called the Williams Initiative for Israel, which we call Wi-Fi here, to become an approved registered student organization through the College Council. And the College Council opted not to make this group a registered student organization, and in so doing, they didn't follow their own guidelines on how to form an organization or not on campus. So really the issue here was focused more on freedom of association, if you want to use language like that, but around who and how we constitute groups on campus, and we used an alternative process that was on the books here for making that group an RSO precisely because under Massachusetts state law, a college student handbook is a binding contract between students and in the institution. And so we really had a legal obligation to offer that process if Wi-Fi requested it, which they did.
Given that student leaders and the administration differed on that issue, are you confident that the student body will also accept this new endeavor from the college to establish this free inquiry, pro-free speech attitude?
Well, I think that the experience pointed to the value of a discussion with Williams students about student governance, and we are engaged in a pretty developed strategic planning work at the college across many domains right now, including college governance, and we look forward to chatting with students in greater depth about the kind of governance they want and deserve at Williams as we think more broadly about our governance structures. And so I'm sure we will continue those conversations going forward in the fall.
Now that the report is in, what's next in this process?
So over the summer, I'm working forward on the 9 recommendations that the ad hoc committee report put forward. I was happy that all of the recommendations made sense for Williams. Some require some institutional structures to be put in place, which we're doing over the summer, and some require some conversations in the fall about implementation and college statements around these issues, and we will be prepared to do that in the fall.
Dr. Maud Mandel is the president of Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Josh Landis. Is meat that's not made of meat still meat? That is the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Another form of alternative meat might be on the horizon. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Garrett Broad, assistant professor in the Department of Communication and Media Studies at Fordham University, looks into its origins.
What is meat? It seems like a simple and obvious question. Meat is food that comes from the flesh of a butchered animal. But what if we changed the definition of meat? What if we could have meat without having to raise and kill animals at all? That's the mission of a growing number of alternative protein advocates who envision a future world of abundant meat without animal slaughter. The industrial production of animals for food has caused a number of big problems, they insist. It contributes to climate change, wastes resources, is bad for public health, and causes suffering to animals. But ethical arguments to turn the world vegan haven't worked. Instead, alternative protein advocates look to food technology to transform how the world eats. Some hope to do this by creating meat directly from plants. Maybe you've tried an Impossible Burger or products from Beyond Meat. They use plants like soy and pea protein as raw materials, then apply food and flavor science to create vegan meat products with the taste and texture of the real thing. But some people don't think those plant-based meats are real enough. That's where cellular agriculture comes in. Here, the idea is to take actual cells from living animals, grow them in a bioreactor, and produce a piece of meat that has the same mix of proteins, amino acids, and enzymes as the original. They call it cell-based, cultured, lab-grown, or clean meat. Companies like Memphis Meats, Just, and Finless Foods have shown the tech is possible, but it's still a long way away from your grocery store. One day, though, they say you could eat a chicken nugget made from the cells of a chicken that is alive and well running around in your backyard. So what is meat? Maybe that's a more complex question than you thought.
That was Garrett Broad of Fordham University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.